welcome to Kick Arts with Emma and Stephen, New Zealand's comprehensive art show brought to you on Planet FM 104.6 and streaming live around the globe thanks to our podcast, which you can download from planetaudio.org.nz. Each week we bring you a variety of interviews and music from across the arts world, from theatre to books, events to exhibitions, we have it covered. Check out what is coming up in your area at kickarts.org.nz. Tonight, we're delighted to chat with the team at the Centre for Arts and Social Transformation from the University of Auckland about their work in arts education. Plus, we'll update you on some great shows and more taking place over the next month. Now, Delta Goodrum is heading to Auckland soon, so to kick off tonight's show, here she is with Born to Try.
Believe.
very talented Delta Goodrum. Are you a fan, Emma?
I am sometimes.
Tickets are quite reasonably priced for September.
When you say reasonably priced, are we talking Lion King price?
125.
Oh, yeah, Lion King price. Okay.
Yeah. But for a concert.
I think that's our new price scale, eh?
Nothing will beat it in Auckland.
The Lion King price, yeah.
Yeah, the Lion King. Now, you went to the Lion King this week. What did you think?
I have mixed opinions on it. I felt that I watched the screen more than the stage, and I felt that a lot of it was lost in such a big space. But, I mean, the performances were great. Took me a little bit to get used to Nick's Kiwi accent and amongst everything else.
Yeah.
But, man, could they sing?
Could they what?
Yes, they could.
Yeah, so cool. And what else did you attend this week?
I've seen two kids' shows this week. I went up to Centre Stage, up to Orewa to see Kids at the Movies, which was a review show. Mm-hmm. And then last night I was at ASB Waterfront Theatre for High School Musical with Auckland Performing Arts Academy.
Ah, cool. Great. Yeah. Lucky them having that fabulous venue.
Yeah, and great to see so many kids on stage.
Nice. I headed along to Madagascar the Musical during the week, and a shout out to our Kick Arts fan, Cole Johnson, because he filled in that night for King Julian and was absolutely outstanding. Yeah.
Gotta love the fart jokes, right?
You do.
The second act with fart jokes were amazing.
Yeah. And nice to be one of the oldest members of the audience for a change, because, man, there was a lot of young people in there. Went and caught up with That Bloody Woman, so agreed with your comments on that. Fantastic production. Well done. I've forgotten her name. You'll remind me who
Brie.
We had in here. Absolutely outstanding. Wasn't she fantastic? Mm. And last night, something really different. Went to Takarua Battle of the Brothers, which was on and is still on at the Aotea Centre. And it's a beautiful cultural show, stories told through dance, especially sort of some of the myths and stories around Taranaki. But as they tell the story, they food and wine match. So as one of the gods catches the eel and it comes flying up on stage, next minute it's on your plate. And it travelled through all these beautiful five courses. It was a stunning night and so cleverly done. We'll talk a little bit more about it later in the show.
And I hear that you were there for a special occasion.
I was. My daughter took me out. That's special enough. She paid for it.
But she took you out because it was your birthday last week.
Yeah, there's a few birthday people in the room tonight. Yeah.
Whose birthday's in the room? Who else?
It was Peter's last week as well.
Oh, there you go.
No, so fabulous, and we'll have a good chat a little later on about some other things coming up.
Yeah.
Now, we've got a very clever-looking group of people in the room tonight. Emma, do you want to kick off by introducing them?
Clever-looking people, I like that. They're all kind of laughing to themselves at the moment. Is that because they're from the university?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. So it's really exciting to have the team from CAST here. So the Castaways from the Centre for Arts and Social Transformation. And we've got Peter, who is the head of the faculty centre. What are we calling you?
I think the director of the centre. I won't go for head of faculty just yet.
Okay. Lovely. And he's going to move in a bit closer. And Peter, how about you introduce the rest of the team to us?
I'd love to. Thank you, Emma. Look, I could go. If you can imagine, I'm sitting right at the edge of this table here, and immediately to my right is Dr. Claudia Rosas Gomez, who is a stunning scholar who is working with us in the centre on a book called The Joy of Slow Wonder. Which is...
she's going to tell us about that.
She'll do that. Professor Helen Sword, who works with us a day a week. Helen is an internationally renowned scholar who does quite incredible work. And she'll talk about that as well. And right next to her, Angela Roberts, who's finishing her... Kelsey Roberts. I was thinking, there you go, you threw me. Kelsey Roberts. Now she's really looking embarrassed. Kelsey is finishing her degree and will be a trained teacher at the end of the year, but works as a research assistant with us. Tani Vo, who's really the boss of the centre, boss of many of our lives at the moment. She's our centre manager. And Dr. Moy Gregorzewski, who's just completed a stunning PhD looking at how you can use drama education to combat rising nationalism and fascism in our home country of Germany and the implications of that for the world.
And Emma's involved in this
to
project
my left,
as well.
Emma, who's working with us at the moment in the centre, creating an oral history of drama education in New Zealand.
I wish we were on television so our listeners could see the smiling faces. Like, that was a very impressive lineup of smiles there, Peter. So tell us, what is the centre all about?
Well, this...
In 5 minutes.
In five minutes. The laughing again.
Yeah. Your time starts now, ding.
Yeah. Give a professor 5 minutes and he'll take 20. The Centre for Arts and Social Transformation is a research centre. It's philanthropically funded. We have extraordinarily generous philanthropists who support our work. Our biggest supporter has been the Chartwell Foundation, the Chartwell Trust. We're also working with the Sir John Kirwan Foundation, funding also from Chalmers Limited, from Cognition Education Trust. And what that's allowed us to do is to bring artist academics, academic artists and others to work together in the centre with a really simple idea, really, that the arts help us to make sense of the world. And when we're really little, we do that by, when we're two or three, pretending to be our mums. And it's actually in that act that we begin to understand who we are in the world and who others are. And picking up on those kinds of things that we, when we paint as 2 and 3 year olds, we make our first marks on the world, we begin to see ourselves as having a place to play. The arts also help us change the world in which we live and our role in the world in which we live. And John Dewey, who is an American philosopher, wrote over 100 years ago that the importance of the arts is that they train the imagination. And the imagination is so vital in a world where, if we are to be better than we are, if this is not just as good as it gets, but we could be something more, then you need a leap of the imagination. You need to be able to imagine it. So the arts are so vital in a world which seems to be stuck, a never-ending crisis. So the centre is around how we might imagine our way out of the post-normal, the constant crisis that we live in. Practically, we do that in a whole range of different ways in the centre. So with practical research, where we are, for example, working with the Kirwan Foundation around arts and mental health. But last year, we were really involved in COVID. And I know I talked to both Emma and Stephen last year, but to both of you last year, about the work that we did with Te Rito Toi. And that work continues. We're really interested in work around the relationship between the arts and terrorism, the arts and growing nationalism and those kinds of things. So that work is practical, it's arts-based, it's research-informed, it's all about making the world a better place than it is at the moment. And really, I guess the wonderful thing about the arts, and for the artists who are listening and thinking, is this just about education? We also know that the most powerful change arts are the most powerful arts, so that we are really interested in making wonderful, beautiful kinds of art that changes the world.
It sounds impressive, and I guess having the funding, and I'm looking at smiling faces, means that it's a chance to, as you said, it's practical, so to bring these dreams to life. So we're going to go around the room and ask, what is your dream project that you're currently working on, that you're bringing to life as part of this? And Claudia, I'm going to start with you. You can grab the mic across. Tell us all about The Joy of Slow Wonder.
Thanks. It's a book that came out of conversations that Peter and I had had. So Peter and I are co-authoring the book together. And in a previous text, actually, that we'd co-edited together, I wrote a chapter in that book about, it was actually about initial teacher education. And I was attempting to talk about the importance of slow wonder. That's kind of where that phrase first crept up, was in that text, where I was saying it was really important for people who were going to become teachers not to feel like they had all the answers, and instead to have a place to actually be able to wonder really slowly, and to be able to kind of hold complexity, to hold tension, because that's the reality, really, of teaching. And so from that, we quite liked the phrase, I think. We liked slow and we liked wonder, and we thought, what if we attempted to write about that concept and kind of talk about it more, and see where that took us. So to that end, I think we're our own process through the text is kind of a slow wandering. So it's sort of forming between us as the time goes on. The thinking behind it is that we're actually writing letters to each other and slowly kind of meandering through things that we're trying to figure out. And the point of the book really is not necessarily to figure them out, but to go through the process of trying to figure things out. At the moment, I think the sorts of things, each of us have kind of got different obsessions, and things that sort of make our hearts beat a little bit faster in education. For me, it really is a lot of things to do with teaching and with education. I'm kind of still in that space. So I guess we're sort of thinking about how we might think against the current orthodoxies. How do we speak back to them in a way that's kind of outside of the space in which they've been captured at the moment? So at the moment, there's particular ways of talking about education. There's particular truths and norms, and it's quite I think of it as quite a strangled space. It's kind of, you know, it's very outcomes focused and things you can measure and so on. And so we're kind of attempting to speak back to that moment, I think, Peter. It feels like the only way to speak back to that moment is to explore other ways of writing that are not traditional forms of academic writing. So kind of using prose, poetry, personal essay, just to go for the alliteration there, as a way of kind of speaking to that space that's currently captured, I think, in ways don't feel satisfying or good and right to Peter and I at the moment. Have I kind of got that?
As always, Claudia, you've said it so poetically. This, we both love The Great Gatsby, and there's right at the very end of the book, there's this extraordinary phrase, boats beating against the current, and the current of education seems to be taking us in the wrong direction, away from a more human-centred approach, and we often feel ourselves as boats beating against the current. And the great joy of that, there's a green light at the end of the dock, although maybe the green light is a bit of treachery as well. Who knows?
Probably is, yeah.
Claudia, for our listeners, perhaps can you give us a little bit of background about you, yourself, personally, and your own journey in education and the arts that sort of led up to joining the centre?
Sure. I always say I had a bit of a backwards journey into teaching. So I did an MA and a BA and an MA in education, predominantly in sociology of education. And at that point, really, it sort of felt like a time to test the theory. You know, here I was believing all of this sociological theory about schools and about education. And so at that point, I became a teacher, and I became a secondary English teacher. So that love of story is kind of in, you know, there's part of the book, there's an old English teacher, you know, that sits within me, that kind of lives in my bones, that thinks that stories are a kind of science, that, you know, there's knowledge there that can be exploited. So I guess that's a belief, a belief and a faith that I bring both to education and to the project, to the centre and to the specific project, the book that we are working on. And then kind of going into the schools, I spent 5-6 years teaching at Aorere College. Some of that time I had the pleasure of teaching, of course, with Emma. Lots of conversations in the Definitely. Staff room between Emma and I, including, I remember, going to see Emma at a production of, at Pukekohe, the Greek.
Zorba.
Zorba the Greek, that's right. So, yeah, lots of connections actually around the room. But so, yeah, so I spent quite a bit of time in my last year at Aotearoa College of teaching English, of seeing the sorts of trends. This was quite some time ago now, very early 2000s. But the sorts of trends that in the context of English, in the context of secondary English, of the ways in which we were differentiating the curriculum for different groups of students. And there was certainly a turn away from literature and from poetry that was considered complex, it was considered too hard, which I thought was a kind of anti-teaching stance. I think, you know, if the answer to complex content is not to teach it, it's just to teach it more and to teach it better.
And I think that was something we came up against a lot at that school.
Yeah.
Given that was the school that I was told the students shouldn't be learning Shakespeare or doing anything European in drama, that we should be sticking to Pacifica Theatre because that was what they knew.
Yeah, and there were good reasons for saying, you know, I get that there's a cultural responsiveness around that, and of course curriculum itself is... It's a tricky space and it is a site of cultural reproduction. So, of course, you know, knowledge is legitimated by being in the curriculum. So I kind of get, I get the push, I get the narrative of the time, but we were also, we didn't think that that should be all that students had access to.
And not when it was teach them what they know because they're going to fail.
Yeah.
Let's try and expand them and encourage them to pass, not to fail.
Yeah, and that was that's part of that whole thing around outcomes. You know, that's the whole pressure on schools and league tables and competition that they have to produce particular results. Whereas our thinking around that was, well, actually, the purpose of education might not necessarily be about outcomes and results. It might be about extending students beyond their ken, and that was where that's where it kind of didn't sit with us. So that's sort of a bit of history, and then beyond that, you know, having decided that sociology was right, was mostly right, went back to the university and I've had a sort of career, I call it, because I have spent a long time also raising my child, and I've been sort of part-time and being a mother, and also trying to be an initial teacher education, and it's lots of rivers, isn't it? It's lots of rivers coming together.
Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. All right, we're going to move around the table and try and capture a little bit from everyone to start with. Helen, maybe preface to start with, I guess, your journey and then how you're involved in the centre.
All right. Well, my journey is that I started out my academic life as a literary scholar, studying poetry, teaching poetry. But then somewhere along the way, basically when I moved to New Zealand 20 years ago, I moved into working in academic development, so kind of teaching the teachers at university level, which meant I moved from being in that kind of academic silo of an English department or literary studies to working with colleagues from all across the disciplines around teaching and learning. And I found that so fascinating. And then I started to become interested in the writing that they were doing in all these different disciplines. And I found that as a literary scholar, I had an ability to look at texts, to do what we call close reading. And I could bring that to looking at a science text or looking at how a psychologist writes or any other discipline. And I ended up becoming fascinated by academic writing, partly by why so much of it is so opaque. Why do academics seem to struggle to communicate clearly and engagingly with the rest of the world? So that kind of eventually became my mission in life, I guess, to try to bring what I call stylish academic writing into the world, or to prove that it's not an oxymoron. There's plenty of it out there, actually, but trying to find it and to empower people to write in engaging ways. And there's really a lot of intersection between the things that Claudia was talking about. I think that that whole sense of the slow wonder and the whole sense of boats beating against the tide have certainly been themes of my work in that way. So I've ended up publishing now three books on writing, first called The Writer's Diet, which is just about sentences, how to write a really kick-ass sentence, and then that moved to Stylish Academic Writing, which is how to be a stylish academic writer by looking at exemplars from different disciplines and following what they do, telling stories, using narrative, all these things that seem kind of blindingly obvious, and yet somehow academics are taught to do the opposite, to write really long-winded sentences that hide everything that you're trying to communicate. And that led then to a book called Air and Light and Time and Space, How Successful Academics Write. And so then that's more about how do academics find the air and the light and the time and the space to get any writing done, to live their academic lives. And that led me to learning about the emotions around academic writing, to interviewing a lot of people about them, and finding that a lot of academic writers actually find pleasure in their writing and bring pleasure to their writing, but nobody talks about that. We talk about the pain of writing. We feel compelled to talk about how hard it all is and how hard we work, because that's the culture we're in. And this idea that slow wonder and joy might be part of what we do, and that bringing slow wonder and joy to what we do might make us better writers and better communicators. That's something a lot of us believe, but somehow it's not out there in the academic discourse. So I'm writing a book now, finishing a book, called Writing with Pleasure, with my fabulous cast colleague, Selena Tous-Talemarche, who couldn't join us here tonight, but she's doing the illustrations for the book, and we are having so much fun and really taking pleasure in writing and pleasure in kind of exploding all kinds of conventions of academic writing as a way, we hope, of empowering others to do the same, empowering writers from all different disciplines to find pleasure in writing, to write more stylishly, to communicate more clearly and engagingly.
And no pressure, but you've kind of set the bar. If you're going to talk about stylish academic writing and then you're writing yourself, yours has to be the exemplar of the lot.
Yeah, it is kind of tough, I have to say. I have to check, you know, even my emails, you know, be really careful about these things. Absolutely. But
and working with Selena, who writes in poetry almost,
oh,
or speaks
right.
in poetry.
That's
like,
right.
Selena's just so amazing when she just opens her mouth and it just kind of comes out stylish.
Absolutely, absolutely. But she brings all of those things to her writing, all of the things that I talk about in my books, about bringing in story, bringing in concrete language, bringing in thinking about sound, thinking about being human in the world. She does all those things as a poet, and you don't have to be a poet to be a wonderful academic writer, but a lot of the skill set or a lot of it. And it's really connected to the whole idea of arts and social transformation, mm-hmm. because really what I'm arguing for and what Selena is doing is bringing an artistic way of thinking, bringing the art of language into academic communication, mm-hmm. In ways both implicit and explicit. So I now am basically running a global writing community called The Write Space. I've got members in at least 30 countries who gather online every week, talk to each other about writing, support each other's writing. Real hunger out there amongst a lot of academics for a more human engagement that will allow them, encourage them to find pleasure in writing and also give them the tools to push against the conventions, give them the courage and the strength and the support to push against some of the academic conventions that kind of tamp people down.
Peter, are you noticing a shift in academic writing?
yes and no, I think. there's some glorious, you know, part of the critical autoethnographic space, I think, is really exciting in terms of those kinds of shifts. And I've always said to my students, if it's awful writing, don't read it. There are so many books in the world. Go and find a book that's well written. If you're struggling with the ideas, that's one thing. If you're struggling with the writing, go and find another academic to read, and there's plenty of them.
Now, Peter, we have to have a music break now, and this music break has a link to you in some way, because I didn't think I'd ever be playing him again. I think the last time I listened to him was in the back of your car, and that's Bob Dylan. So what's Bob Dylan's link to your group?
Well, Bob Dylan is the patron of the Centre for Arts and Social Transformation. It's the only thing in the world that Bob Dylan is the patron of. So we're pretty excited about
that. Did that require some pretty, you know, stylish academic writing to get that
it
moment?
It does, you know. And Bob turned 80 the other week, and we had a birthday party for him, and sent him a picture of us celebrating his birthday.
Brilliant. All right, here's a bit of Bob Dylan for our Sunday evening.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. There's no telling who that it's naming, 'cause the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing. Come senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. Mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing. Drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.
The wonderful Bob Dylan. Never thought I would play that on Kick Arts, but thanks, Peter, for bringing that back into our world. Emma, speaking of musical wonderments, we've got a special competition at the moment.
We have. Our competition is still running to find our new jingle, our intro and outro. So you've got till the end of the month. So we're looking for 30 seconds to a minute. And fantastic prize from our friends at Orise Creative Group, who are giving a $3,500 music video package to the winner of the jingle writing.
Absolutely.
And, of course, they'll get to be played.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, we're coming up 10 years, Kick Arts, and it's time for a new sound. So please fire us your suggestions by the end of the month to info@kickarts.org.nz. Send us an email if you need all the terms and conditions. We can fire that right back to you. Now, speaking of things here at Planet FM, we are moving studios soon and very delighted to be moving into a brand new digital age. If you've ever been into this studio, you'll know that we're something out of the TV show Frasier back in the 80s, but it still works. But we're finally going digital. They have fundraised for some time and have brought a brand new premises in Mount Albert, but are now just needing that little bit extra for all the fit out. And it's important to note that Planet FM teams up with five other fantastic not-for-profit organisations, including the Red Cross, Aotearoa Resettle Community Coalition, Belong Aotearoa, Asylum Seekers Support Trust, and the Refugee Health and Wellbeing Trust. So, to support this move and all those fabulous organisations, head to planetfm.org.nz/donate. Now, we're back with our wonderful guests. And, Peter, as I hear you talk, I can sense that frustration by education. And as long as I've known you, there's been different frustrations about education. Have you spotted some glimmers of hope, or is it still purely frustration?
There's a moral responsibility to hope.
Yeah.
And I'm always hopeful for change. One of the big things which has happened lately is we released Te Reto Toi last year, which was to support schools during COVID. And one of the things that we know was that, because of the research that we've done, is that probably more arts was taught last year after lockdown than in a generation. You know, we had 250,000 people down, teachers across the country, view the site. We had webinars with over 40,000 teachers here in Australia who were saying, yeah, the arts are the way to re-engage children when they come back. And just a couple of weeks ago, we launched our new Te Reto Toi site, which is a way back to schools after any crisis using the arts. And we had the Honourable Jan Tonetti, who is the Associate Minister for the Arts, responsible for the curriculum, say she was really keen to engage with us in the centre and to make the difference, to make the change. So I'm forever hopeful, grumpy as ever, Stephen, but hopeful that the change is possible. And, you know, Seamus Heaney says, you know, if you wait long enough, hope and history rhyme, that there is a time. And maybe we're finally there.
Mm. And you're right about the arts post-COVID. I mean, Emma and I have found, you know, outside even school settings, we've never had so much theatre and art exhibitions and dance as we have since about August last year through to now. You only have to look at our inbox, don't we, Emma? Every week there's so many things happening, which is great, because that must then hopefully filter back to those important people that lead our education system, that the arts is alive in New Zealand.
Yeah, you know, the Prime Minister said once, you know, that she craved a time when people used the word well-being, the next word they used was the arts.
Mm.
And so, you know, if we can translate that into action, if we can take that and say, yeah, absolutely. We actually see it, of course, in the Centre for Arts and Social Transformation, that we have people lining up and saying, we really believe in what you're doing, donating to what we're doing. You know, we're really busy, and we're really busy in that arts and wellbeing, that arts and crisis space. And I think, you know, one of the things that we might have learned from COVID is that the arts aren't a luxury. They're the thing that holds individuals together often, but they also hold communities and nations together. They do that because they help us grieve, they help us celebrate who we are, they do, you know, they help us interrogate our histories, they do all those vital things. And, you know, if we're to gain anything out of the last year of COVID, maybe as a nation it might be a deeper regard for the possibility of the arts.
Mm, absolutely. Brilliant answer. Very stylish. That's my word of the night. Thank you, Helen. Kelsey is one of the youngest members around the table tonight, taking a presumption there, of course, but tell us a little bit about yourself and how exciting it is to be involved in this when you're just sort of starting out. Are you the next Peter O'Connor in waiting?
So I'm currently doing my Bachelor of Education. I'm in my last year, last semester now. And at the end of my second year, I got a summer research scholarship. So that meant I got to work at the office. So that was my first introduction to CAST, I guess, because in high school I did drama. So I was always interested in the arts. But within university, I just hadn't really been doing that much with it. So I started off at CAST, I guess my first project that I worked on with Iris the other summer, research scholar, was Te Reo Toi. So we basically, I guess what we started off by doing was kind of transcribing things, doing lots of things to support you guys to make the report. And then lately I've been working on a book with Peter, and it's basically a big Routledge...
Companion. Companion to drama education.
Nice. Yeah.
And it's pretty big, right, Kelsey? Yes. How many authors?
So there's 74 authors. And
how many chapters?
290,000 words and 56 chapters. So I've basically been working on the administration side of that, so trying to get all the authors to send in everything and sorting that all out.
What's been your biggest learning curve to date?
I think, like, when I started at the centre, and Peter, we always laugh about this, like sitting on the table on that first day, I've never been in many... not saying serious business situations, but even that first day sitting down with, like, you know, Alex and Peter, and they're like, so tell us about yourself, you know, like, what do you want to get out of this? I think it's been quite a learning curve for me to kind of get into more professional settings and kind of start to work on that kind of business side.
Nice. And if Peter came to you tomorrow and said, Kelsey, I've just been given $200,000, it's yours for your dream project, what would you do? I'm really putting you on the spot here, but no, I'm curious.
I think, well, what I like about CAST is how we all work together on everything. So I think I definitely have to think about that a lot.
Yeah.
But I do love, yeah, how we do everything together. So maybe finding out what ideas other people have and kind of collaborating and, you know, bouncing ideas off and then seeing what we can do from there.
Nice answer. You're a keeper. Yeah, absolutely. Cool. That's really cool. And Emma, what's your project? You are doing some research in here?
I am doing... well, I haven't started yet. I'm meant to have, but I haven't. It's been an interesting journey. So I'm doing a oral history of drama and education in New Zealand. So basically getting the stories at the moment is the first part of the research, so that we've got a little bit of an archive. It kind of came out of the realisation that a lot of the people who helped shape, especially the Drama Association in New Zealand, are ageing. Is that a nice way to put it, Peter? Ageing?
Well, don't look at me and say ageing.
Are slowly ageing, and right, that we need to get their anecdotes and stories while we've got the opportunity. And for me, I think a lot of it came from having gone to Drama Australia to a conference a couple of years ago in Melbourne, obviously before COVID times, and they had done their, what they were calling their Mama and Muma, I think is the acronym for it. So they were doing the archive project, and they had taken the stories from 35 people from the Melbourne state who had been teaching for more than 35 years and had collaborated and pulled together with some research fellows and created a ethnographic play that was presented as a keynote. And it was absolutely phenomenal to see. And just them having... so all of their states were getting recordings of their people and realising that we just didn't have that here in New Zealand. So when we've got amazing people like Sunny Amy, who's now in her 90s, all these amazing people that need to have their stories told. So that's the plan.
Cool. Does it link into the project Kelsey's talking about with creating this amazing resource as well? Are there people that you're meeting that you're going, hey, is it time to revise that and pop it in here?
Probably not, no.
No?
I think at the moment, once we've got the stories, it's then looking at part of my project as well as to make some recommendations going forward. Hopefully it will become some academic writing, and I might have to take some inspiration from Helen's work, of course, and be back at writing myself, which is a bit scary, actually, because I haven't academically written since I did my master's over 10 years ago. So it's all a bit scary. But we'll see how it grows. It's an organic process.
Nice, nice. All right, moving around the table now to Moi. So you've been waiting patiently. Give us a little bit about your background, and obviously that's played a huge part in your journey here in CAST.
Yes, I've been an applied theatre practitioner for a long time. I guess I started out as a child who was a participant in drama projects and theatre programmes, and I remember I was thinking, how did this journey start, when you ask the others? And I think it started when I was maybe 4, and my mum dropped me off at like a community children's theatre place, and I got to be Pippi Longstockings for a couple of hours. And I could experience that. I could imagine myself differently, that I could, you know, carry my horse on my little finger around my city. And I guess that's kind of how my love for drama began. And then I came back to New Zealand. So I'm from Germany originally. I came to New Zealand about 4 years ago to start my PhD in applied theatre, looking at drama education and right-wing populism in Germany. And now I'm here, so that's kind of my journey in a nutshell. I finished it, finally, this year. Yay! And then I started working at the Centre for Arts and Social Transformation.
So what's next on the horizon?
Next on the horizon is a very exciting project that we're working on at the moment, funded by the John Kirwan Foundation. So we're working in partnership with them, and I am part of the evaluation team of that project called Mighty, and we're looking at how drama-based pedagogies can facilitate mental health education in New Zealand primary schools, and we're looking specifically at the Mighty approach as a whole school approach. So how can these pedagogies engage everyone that's part of that wider school community, and how can that really make a difference in mental health in this country?
Have you seen good examples of that in primary schools?
Yeah. So we've done a set of interviews already, and what's really... Can I talk about this? Maybe not quite, but it is definitely very interesting shifts in thinking that maybe I can mention here now that I found very, very encouraging and hopeful.
Might be useful to say that the centre created the arts-based...
Right.
...tools... for the use of the Kirwan Foundation, and now what we're doing is looking to see how successful they were. And so we've been using, for example, Mophead, which was written by Selena, who's a cast member, and that's been ways in which you can look at racism and stereotyping and its impacts on mental health. And you can do that with, is it year 5 and 6s, Moi?
I think so.
Yeah.
The Mophead ones, yeah.
The Mophead ones, yeah. So, you know, we've been using Aroha's Way with little ones and all sorts of different kinds of processes. We're just about... Moi's leading the writing of the report at the moment that we're doing for the John Kirwan Foundation. And I think we could talk a little bit about some of the really exciting things that we've discovered.
All right.
take it away.
Take it away. Are you sure? excellent. So, well, we've find interesting is that it's kind of a fundamental shift in thinking is starting to happen among senior, if I can say that, among senior leadership in different schools. And I think it ties into the title of your book, the Joys of Slowness or Slow Wonder, leadership teams really thinking about, hey, I think we should really slow down the curriculum, and that is what we need to do, and we need to really start with these human relationships at our school, and not only ensure that there's inclusion among the children or among children and teachers, but among staff as well, right? Mm. So you can't say, okay, we're going to engage the children in learning about mental health, but then you kind of leave everyone else out, all the other school staff out of that consideration.
Interesting. I love this idea of slowing down, but then I see all these teenagers, I've got a couple myself, who are in this speed world of NCA and assessments and now post-COVID having this life outside of school, which we encourage. Do we have to start at this primary level so that in a few years we notice that slowdown take place?
Well, I would, Peter and I are just looking at each other. I would say yes, because my feeling is, I'm not an expert in, you know, in New Zealand schools, but otherwise you just try to fix the damage that's already done if you start at secondary level.
And I have a 2.5-year-old granddaughter who engages in the world in an extraordinary dance of slow wonder. Everything has a wonder, beauty and a joy to it. And keeping that in school seems to me to be of vital importance. Coincidentally, there's an extraordinary exhibition at the Auckland Art Gallery at the moment called Slow Wonder. They're running tours at the moment on wandering with curiosity through the slow wonder of Kober's work. It's for anyone who really wants to spend an hour or two looking at light and what light does, and taking time to do that, taking time to notice the world. We risk a great deal when we lose our sense of wonder, and I think that's kind of at the heart of our book and heart of much of the work that we do, that the world's a wonderful place and we should wonder about that wonderfulness.
All right, I'm heading over now to the person in charge of all this wonder. I don't know, I imagine the hardest part of being the manager of the centre is keeping the enthusiasm under control, because there'll be so many ideas on a daily basis. So, Tane, how do you do it? How do you keep this lot wrangled?
So I don't focus on just one or any particular project. I'm everywhere and anywhere. Wherever CAS is, whatever CAS do, I'd be there to provide supports where I can. It's really funny for me, I guess. Not very long ago, I would have never thought that I'd be working in the arts or education industry. And I even said to Peter when I first started, I said, Peter, I'm not creative at all. And then Peter gave me a hard look, and then he said, Tani, everyone is creative. Creativity is not about you being able to draw or sing or play an instrument. It's about, it can be risk-taking or it can be curiosity. And I was like, yes, that's me. I am curious. I love taking risks. I love problem posing. So yes, I am creative. So now I'm, you know, when someone said to me, I'm not creative, I just laugh at them. And if there's someone who close to me, I would tap on their shoulder and I said, Matt, sit down and let me tell you.
So what was your background that led to coming in and meeting Peter and the team? What were you doing prior to this?
Well, I was working in the events industry. I love events management, and that's the reason that I'm here in New Zealand. I moved here 10 years ago, and it's all because I have a dream of working in the events industry, but events management wasn't really something in my country. So I always dream of going out there to the war and see what they are doing out there with the events industry. So I came here, I graduated about 6 years ago, and then I've been working in the events industry since then. But I just love organizing things. I love organizing things. I love administration stuff.
I love it that your team are all nodding. They're all going, yeah. Yeah, because one of the biggest problems with creative people is they're often that the admin and that the organising does fall out a little bit because they can see they've got the vision and the dream. They need someone to crack that whip beside them and say, no, you do need to hand that receipt in, thanks. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you love most about working for Cast?
I am so grateful to be able to be part of all these inspiring projects, especially those that about helping children, like the Territory Toy that Peter mentioned earlier, or the Mighty program from John Kerwin Foundations, because I think helping children is about helping our future. So I think it's really inspiring. And to be honest, I'm still at my young age. But I really hope that one day I can bring Territory Toy to Vietnam, my home country, and I want to change the whole education system in Vietnam.
Well, that's a pretty awesome goal to have. Pretty awesome goal to have. Absolutely. All right, we're going to take a short music break now, and then after the break, we'll find out the long-term goals of Cast Plus. Check in with all the wonderful things that have hit our inbox this week. Here is Ben Platt's latest number, Happy to be Sad.
The armor that I need to face the day. For a second I forgot that you were leaving soon. Then the armor falls away. This time there's no broken hearts and no one ran, 'cause it got hard. This missing you is temporary pain. I'm happy to be sad. You were gone. If I was feeling nothing, I would feel like something's wrong. I'm grateful to be crying. I'm crying over you. I'm lucky that we love so good it has to hurt this bad. I'm happy to be sad. And all my thoughts, I thought that I would start to crumble in the lonely. But I'll get to know the momentary misery, just to know somebody knows me. This time there's no hopeless nights, no losing sleep, no pointless fights, just missing you till you come back and hold me. Happy to be sad. Sad that you are gone. If I was feeling nothing, I would feel like something's wrong. I'm grateful to be gone. Crying over you. Lucky that we love so good it has to hurt this bad. I'm happy to be sad. I'm happy.
wonderful Ben Platt with his latest offering, Happy to Be Sad. Now, our inbox continues to fill up, which is fantastic. And Emma, some people are supporting Kick Arts by purchasing some promos, which we are promoting them all over our social media, our websites. It's fantastic.
Yeah, if you jump onto our new website, kickarts.org.nz, you'll see on our events page now that we've got some featured ads there, as well as our free listing. So if you've got anything coming up that you want publicised, do let us know at info@kickarts.org.nz. But in our inbox from Praise Theatre, proud supporters of Kick Arts, comes The Morning After, in collaboration with Agnaram Productions. They have brought you the latest three installments of First World Problems and presented an ensemble version of The Morning After at Basement in 2015, which was a sellout. Now, 6 years later, this award-winning work returns again with a whole new script and a live band for a limited one-week season only at Q Theatre. A must-see piece of local South Asian theatre playing the 20th to the 25th of July at the Loft Theatre. So head to qtheatre.co.nz to book.
And as I talked about at the start of the show, also supporting Kick Arts at the moment is Takura Battle of the Brothers, a unique cultural experience synthesising hospitality, theatre and dance. Audiences will enjoy a sumptuous five-course banquet, which is matched with amazing wines, interwoven with a stunning theatrical display of Pacifica contemporary dance and Māori martial arts. Euro-sensational head chef Wallace Moore Frost serves up a feast of Neo-Pacifica cuisine, interpreting ancient stories on the origins of Māori and Pacific food culture. It's brought to life in a wildly energetic dance theatre performance. You are welcome to join the celebration, and it's on at the Aotea Centre. Currently, until the end of the month, head to aucklandlive.co.nz for all the details.
And last year we featured the writer of The Way of the Ruakura, the Parihaka musical, as it celebrated its debut here in Auckland. Now funded for season two in Auckland and in Taranaki, they are seeking cast for this year's season. So head to parihakamusical.co.nz for all audition information.
And in perhaps her most spectacular work to date, choreographer Marina Gray is taking on the complexities of intergenerational relationships, the art of karanga, and the escalation of climate change in her new multidisciplinary work, Karanga. Playing at Q Theatre from the 5th of August, head to qtheatre.co.nz to find out more.
And Proudly Asian Theatre and Hand Pulled Collective are proud to present the premiere season of Pork and Pull Texas, a play by Tali Pua. This theatrical experience is directed by multidisciplinary creative Tala Pua, and starring an all-Asian cast. Pork and Pull Texas follows a Chinese family across Aotearoa in China during the Chinese poll tax era. It's a timely narrative that explores family relationships, migration and racism. Their team is excited to bring this story to life and is another step in the fight for better Asian representation in the creative arts and in history. So that's playing at the Herald Theatre from the 10th of August, and head to aucklandlive.co.nz for more information.
And finally, we were deeply saddened to hear of the passing on Friday the 9th of July of a lifelong advocate and supporter of children's literature, Betty Gilderdale, just days short of her 98th birthday. Generations of children will know Betty as the author of the much-loved series of five Little Yellow Digger picture books, which she created alongside her artist husband, Alan. With over 500,000 Little Yellow Digger books in print, the original picture book stands out as one of New Zealand's all-time best-selling children's picture books, a wonderful legacy to leave the world of children's publishing. It's a legacy that's been continued by their son Peter, who has taken up the mantle of writing new books in the series. We send our best wishes to her family at this time and invite you to head to YouTube for a great clip where Jennifer Ward-Leland reads the Little Yellow Digger book with the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra accompanying. If you have something to share with us, email us at info@kickarts.org.nz. Now, back with our studio guests. And Peter, there's a few people part of cast that are not here tonight. Do you or any of your team want to talk a little bit about some of the projects they're working on?
Sure, happy to, Stephen. I'm just thinking, you know, as you're going through that list of what's on, you know, we know, don't we, as a city, that the arts and social transformation are totally and completely interweaved, all those plays, those stories and all the rest of it. And the Little Yellow Digger gets read in our house all the time because it's my granddaughter's favourite book. And it's lasted for so long. It's extraordinary, isn't it? That the arts live on beyond us. And, you know, Ellen and Amity, just gorgeous, gorgeous book.
You'll have to put the Jennifer on so that she can listen to it rather than you reading
that?
It.
And that kind of the importance of the arts in our lives from when we're very little, listening to Moy talk about, you know, when she's four. You know, I think of, you know, the extraordinary work that you do, Stephen, with Kids for Drama, that you catch those little ones at four and it changes their lives. It's really as simple as that at one level, isn't it? We've got a whole bunch of other people working in the centre who are doing extraordinary things. Kristen Napier-Robertson, who has been working with us for a year and works on multiple projects with us, has just designed a beautiful piece of work for Te Rito Toi, looking at self-portraiture and really exciting ways to do that. She used to be the education manager at the Auckland Art Gallery. Krista is a really important part of our team, and she's at home with her three-year-old, so she couldn't be with us tonight. Selena Tusitala-Marsh is that's a great gift to the centre, having Selena, and she's a great mate of Helen, so Helen's going to chuck it over to Helen to talk about Selena and what she's up to.
Well, I know one thing Selena's up to is that her book, her children's book, Mophead, is also being performed alongside the APO. So it's not just the Little Digger that's getting the APO musical treatment. Selena is a scholar-poet, as she would describe herself, so both a really eminent scholar of Pacific literature and a fabulous poet. And then a few years ago, she just started doodling on her iPad, and next minute, she'd written Mophead, published by Auckland University Press, their first foray into publishing a children's book, and then last year it just swept all the children's book awards, won the Supreme Margaret Mahi Award. So Selena's just this sort of font of creativity in all these different media. But what she's been doing for years and years is going into schools to get kids excited about poetry and to get kids using poetry to explore their own identities and to build their identities and build their self-confidence. So she's been walking the talk. She's been using the arts for social transformation in the schools forever, pretty much. And now with Mophead, she has, and Mophead 2, the sequel, she has this actual platform for bringing these messages that are communicated through her books, which Peter's already talked about finding self-confidence, about being yourself, and all kinds of issues of colonialism are addressed in Mophead 2, where Selena or Mophead goes and reads for the Queen in London, which Selena actually did. So all of these themes now are being brought into the New Zealand curriculum and into various resources that CAST is involved with, like Te Rito Toi. So it's all very kind of synergistic.
Woven.
Yeah, very interwoven. It's really difficult for me to be tossed a question like, tell me about what Selena does.
Sorry, Matt. <Matt. laughs>
And we were actually privy to seeing the kids' reactions to Selena. Was it last week we were at Sylvia Park for the relaunch of Te Rito Toi?
Yeah, there's this huge excitement. You know, a school where most of the kids were Pacific Island Māori, and they were overjoyed at seeing Pacifica writer, a poet, someone that they knew,
Selena,
someone who was alive.
Wave at me.
And they all wanted photos. It was incredible. She was a real rock star in their presence, wasn't she?
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was very cool.
And we've got one other member of our team, Marta Estelles, Dr. Marta Estelles, who's leading a UNESCO-funded project on arts beyond borders, and that's looking at how we might create some resources for senior secondary to explore the issues around citizenship, countering all sorts of issues which lead towards children understanding themselves as global citizens. And so there's a team of us from across the city, actually across the country now, working on that. And Mart is leading that work. So that's our team.
Brilliant.
Mm. And I mentioned it just before about the relaunch of Te Reo Toi. So, Peter, do you want to tell us a little bit about what that was all about?
So the relaunch of Te Reo Toi was to... was as the result of the research that Kelsey talked about before, where we looked at schools that had used Te Reo Toi as their way back after lockdown, and we found that we'd done some things really well and there were some things missing. You know, when Te Reo Toi went out last year, it was the first resources to support teachers in schools to teach Māori arts, to teach Ngā Toi, and that was grabbed at. So we were really lucky to get a little bit of funding at the beginning of this year to work with Dagmar Dyke at Sylvia Park and produce the first Pacifica Arts resource, the first resources for teachers to teach Pacifica Arts. And she's created two gorgeous pieces of two gorgeous resources for Te Reo Toi, and that was part of our launch out at Sylvia Park. But we've also worked our way into a situation of saying Te Reo Toi was really important after COVID, but it's really important after any crisis. And so we've reframed Te Reo Toi so that it's now there and available for schools after anything, from the floods that have been devastating the South Island at the moment, to fires, to smaller local tragedies, crises which impact on schools. And we're working hard to make sure that the ministry is right alongside us in getting that into schools. New Zealand Principals Federation, New Zealand Education Institute, UNESCO, whole range of partners in alongside with us, getting the arts into schools, that whole business of slow wonder.
I heard you off here talk something about the Lincoln Centre.
Yeah, so you... One other thing, you know, I know, Stephen, you said that you're going to talk to us about plans. You know, we actually did our strategic plan as a centre, as a poem.
Okay.
We'd recommend that to anybody. You know, rather than sitting and working out all these operational goals, try it as a poem. It's a lot more fun, and probably closer to the truth. But what we keep finding is serendipity, where things arise and you grab at them if you notice them. If you slow the world down long enough and well enough, you can see all sorts of chances. So we've been invited to be part of the inaugural international hubs for the International Teaching Artist Consortium. And so we get to be partners with the Lincoln Center in New York, similar organizations in Norway and in South Korea, getting the nod there from Tani, making sure I'm remembering everything. We had our first conversation Saturday morning out of the Lincoln Center in New York, where we talked about what it is to be a teaching artist, what it is that we have to offer. And we see ourselves now as the New Zealand hub, the hub for this part of the world, building the kinds of connections, relationships, both nationally and internationally from here. So it links into the other work that Helen's been doing around the artist academic and all the work that we've been doing. So it's an exciting new project for the centre that kicked off just in the last couple of days.
Where would you like to see the centre in sort of 5 or 10 years' time?
I'd like to see it about the same size as a lot of these science centres.
Right.
I'd love... Wouldn't it be lovely if we kind of got the same... Wouldn't it be amazing if the arts were as valued as science, technology and maths and all the rest of it? You know, we have an extraordinary history in this country too of the arts and education, from Peter Fraser, Clarence Beebe, Gordon Tovey, all those extraordinary, you know, Sandy Adshead, Ralph Hawthorne, Colin McCann, they're all part of an extraordinary blossoming of the arts, and especially the arts and education, Alwyn Richardson, the whole group of people. And it's not about hearkening back to that, but, you know, we do walk backwards into the future, so we know, that we've done it before and we could do it again. That you know, it's New Zealand seems to be, you know, huge constitutional questions that we're asking ourselves, whole shift in who we are as a country. Where are the arts in that?
I think one of the things
should be part of that.
And yeah. I think one of the things that's really hard with the arts as well is, of course, the whole funding around the arts, because we don't get the recognition as artists. And the hard thing is too, as outside of artists outside of education, like, you approach them and say, well, what about education? But as soon as a creative applies for funding and says it's something to do with education, funders turn around and say, well, we don't fund education because that's the ministry's job. But then the ministry don't give us funding either. So it is a tricky thing, and that's where the centre's very lucky with, as Peter's already said, the Kirwan Foundation, the Chartwell Trust,
and it's the only way
education.
To do it, is external funders. Yeah.
Philanthropic people that are prepared to throw money at our way.
Yeah, and, you know, the level of funding is a problem for artists in New Zealand, but it's the way we fund as well, so it's competitive. Mm. Everyone's scrambling around at the bottom.
And it's often short-term, you know, if you're going to build a project, you need to know I've got 5 years funding. Like, sign it now, and unless I muck up, then I want to keep getting it each year so I can grow it. It's too hard.
I mean, if you think back to the arts and craft movement, you know, in the 1950s, early 60s, people like Ralph Hawthorne, Colin McCann, Sandy Adshead, they got five-year contracts with the Ministry of Education. It meant that they were making art around the community, and they had a job doing that. They were teaching artists. They were the great example of the possibilities. Mm. You know, not scrambling around from one project to the other. I mean, the Creatives in Schools project, there's some extraordinarily beautiful work being done in it. You get $10,000 for 12 weeks work. That's not a career. That's not a sustainable process for artists to really engage in developing who they are. That model does nothing to build or to sustain arts in New Zealand.
And again, it's the model of the creative goes into school, does this amazing work for 10 weeks, and then leaves, and the teacher's left behind going, how did they do that? And not being able to carry it forward.
Or the teacher's not able to do it in slow wonder and is going, oh my goodness, I need to fit 10 other things into my day, and now I've got an arts practitioner here slowing down my day. How do we change that mode?
Well, we change it piece by piece, you know. So I guess, you know,
pre-service teaching.
Well, you know, the initial teacher education in the arts is appalling. You know, and I'm saying,
don't get it started, because we've only got 10 minutes.
But it actually, you know, it's because it's part of a wider issue, I think, that Claudia's kind of talked about with the book. It's about there are other ends, there are other currents, there are other things which are orthodoxies about how things are done that really don't do what need to be done. And I think, you know, one of the things about Te Reo Toi was that, and much of our work is that it's, I have this fear that our least creative teachers are our recent graduates.
That, should we ask, throw know, a question to Kelsey?
Yeah.
Kelsey, what do you hope your classroom is going to look like next year?
I'm actually doing my honours year next year.
So the year after that.
I think I've been thinking about it a lot, especially being around these people, and I do have concerns about, like, the school management systems in terms of if they're going to give me the space and the opportunity to put the arts in it. Because I think especially as a beginning teacher, you have your mentor teacher, you have a lot of people saying, you know, do your reading, do your maths, do your, you know, technology, like do these specific things. And obviously I would love to do lots of arts, but I think it's a little bit hard and a little bit scary to think about, is like, will I have that kind of support in the future?
Mm. the lens on or pedagogy of the arts rather than a specialist subject is something that's not seen in a lot of schools now.
And choose your school wisely. Just as much as you get interviewed for a school, you need to interview the school as well. Do your homework, do your research and make sure it's one that is going to support and grow you.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah. It's a 50-50 thing there. We're down to our last 5 minutes. I want to do some quick fires, Emma, for our traditional kick arts quick fires, because some of them have had to sit quietly for a bit, so we can't possibly have that. So, Claudia, these are quick fire questions. Who inspires you the most or has inspired you the most?
I think all women writers. Yeah, all women writers. Currently, Deborah Levy, her latest instalment of her living autobiography, Real Estate, is just, causing lots of wonder in me. It's wonderful. Deborah Levy.
Nice, nice. Moi, who inspires you?
I would say my mum, probably, because she never conformed to any ideal image of a woman or what a woman should be like. I think I'm a lot like her in that way.
Nice. Tane, I'm really curious, with all these amazing projects and Peter's vision for the future, as centre manager, how do you make it stay alive? What do you see as your biggest role?
My biggest role, trust Peter.
No pressure, Peter.
At the moment, he's my inspiration, and I trust him on the journey that he's got working on, and just trust him and support him as much as I can.
Okay, good.
And manage his diary and make sure he turns up on time and give him at least half an hour's notice before he has to move.
Yes.
Helen, if you could go back and talk to your 16-year-old self, knowing what you know ahead, what would you say to your 16-year-old Helen?
It's all going to be okay. I guess I'm not sure I would want to be that kid again, although I think I was pretty wide-eyed and excited, and I think I would say to any 16-year-old, be brave, follow your heart, follow your gut. Don't let anybody tamp down your creativity. That is your superpower.
Nice. Kelsey, you're addressing the first-year Teachers Training College team, and what advice are you giving to all these sort of 18, 19, 20-year-old young teachers in that room day one?
I think I would say, do absolutely everything that you can when you go out on placements. Don't hold back and try to, take the easy way. Always push yourself to go as far as you can and do as much as you can on those placements, because then that's how you grow as a teacher and as a person.
Oh, nice.
That was a good one,
Yeah, very good. Peter, many, many weeks on the show we talk about arts and mental health, music and mental health. We have shows come in, we have people writing songs, all sorts. It's a constant topic. How do we merge it all together so we're creating something collaboratively that does make a difference? How do we get to that step? Because there's so much good stuff out there, but it's all...
Well, I guess a set that you... I don't know, Stephen... I've been working on this for 40 years, whether it's been around family violence or child abuse. Kelsey thinks she knows the answer. I don't know. If we did...
Because we want the answer.
We want the answer. And I don't think we have the answer. We have ways of thinking about what it is that we might do. There's no magic wand in this. It is about advocacy. It's about research. It's about doing the hard yards. But I get a feeling and Claudia and I are writing about it. It's believing. It's about being believers, which is different to knowing things. And one of the things I think we have in common as a centre is a belief. And it's a belief in the arts and the power, the possibility, the potentiality of the arts to really make the difference. it's about building those networks with others who also believe, who want to be part of what it is that we do.
Beautiful way to leave it there. Thank you so much to the wonderful team from CAST. Stay in touch. We'd love to hear where your projects take you, what happens next when you get to Vietnam. It's really important to keep this story alive, and thanks, Emma, for bringing the team in tonight.
No worries at all.
What's your week like ahead?
A little bit crazy and a little bit not. I'm going and have a meeting with Peter on Tuesday to get my stuff
under. Is that the crazy bit?
That's the crazy bit. And then I'm flying to Dunedin to see That Bloody Woman with Tyree, have their opening night for that. And then I'm going to Christchurch to run a workshop for students aged 11 to 18 on nailing their auditions. And then I'm coming back to start the term.
Brilliant. That's a busy week. James is filling in for you next week. And next week we have the team from Auckland University Stray Theatre coming in, plus several parts, if you like, in the jigsaw of the Going West Festival, which this year is larger than ever. So some of them are joining us next week as well. If you have something to share with us, email us at info@kickarts.org.nz. And don't forget our fabulous music competition. Write us that jingle, win a fantastic prize of $3,500 worth of music videos. We're going out tonight with a song from The Wedding Singer, which is coming, the musical, in September to Auckland. Make sure you grab your tickets. Have a fabulous week, everyone, and make sure you
kick some arts.
Did you see the bride? She looks so perfect.
I know. Don't you hate her?
Hate her? She's so happy.
She turns around and she meets his gaze. The lights are dim, there's a smoky haze. They share a smile and a secret way. It's a moment built to say. They start to move across the floor. The room is frozen, wanting more. The happy couple on display, with nothing standing in their way. It's so romantic, I could die right here and now. It's gonna be that way for us. I know somehow, someday when it's me, I'll know our love was meant to be. Not one single complication or cause for hesitation. Someday when the dream is coming true, all you'll need is me, and all they'll need is you.
Julia, take that veil off.
Okay. They stop and pose for a photograph. He jokes around just to make her laugh. The room is full, but they're all alone. They have a language all their own. And I'm so jealous I could cry. And yet I know it won't be long before you say we're good to go. Someday when it's me, I'll know our love was meant to be. Not one single complication or cause for hesitation. Someday when the dream is coming true, all you'll need is me, and all I'll need is you. I've seen the